Welcome back to the deep dive. If you're getting ready to step onto a clinical floor, you already know this, pharmacology. It isn't just another class. It's pretty much the ultimate test of your competence.
That's absolutely right. It's where your critical thinking, your math skills, and all those life-saving safety systems, they all just collide in one moment.
And the stakes couldn't be higher.
Not at all. And, you know, the real job of the nurse isn't just like memorizing 1,000 drug interactions. The real job is mastering this intricate safety scaffolding. That's what ensures a powerful chemical gets to the right person at the right time, without fail.
Today, we are doing a deep dive into that very scaffolding. The material we're working from is, well, it's the foundational roadmap for future nurses. It's all about the core responsibilities, the systemic checks, and the essential calculations that really define safe practice.
Exactly. And our mission here is to move you beyond just rote memorization into, you know, true critical application. We're going to be focusing on the four pillars of safe pharmacology.
Okay, what are they?
Well, first, integrating your clinical judgment with the nursing process. Second, understanding the technology that backs up all your safety checks. Third is using structured tools for prioritization and collaboration. And, you know, crucially, mastering the math. That math is the difference between a therapeutic dose and a critical error.
It really is. So let's unpack this. We want to instill the confidence you need to, you know, pause the entire system when something just feels wrong. And speaking of confidence, let's start where every nurse starts, with your central role in medication administration.
It's such a unique position. I mean, the provider prescribes, the pharmacist dispenses, but the nurse. Mm-hmm. The nurse is the final essential filter.
It's the last line of defense.
Absolutely. You're the last human professional to physically interact with that drug before it enters the client's body. So if an error, and it could have started way back at the prescribing stage, if it's going to be caught, the nurse is the one who has to catch it.
Which connects directly to that concept that anchors all of nursing practice. Clinical judgment. And this isn't just about, you know, reading a checklist.
Not at all.
It's about pulling in multiple streams of data in real time. Our source material lays out this fantastic circular alignment between the standard nursing process, the Tanner clinical judgment model, and the six cognitive operations from the action model.
And that integration is just so crucial for a nursing student today. It really gives you a map for your critical thinking. Especially with pharmacology. It pushes you away from just, you know, completing tasks to proactively making decisions.
Okay, let's map that alignment out then. So the Tanner model, it starts with noticing.
Right, noticing. Mm-hmm. It's the immediate recognition of what's going on, and it aligns perfectly with the assessment phase of the nursing process.
Which in the cognitive operations model is recognize cues. They're all different words for the same thing.
Exactly. So think about it in a pharmacology context. You're gathering cues. Is the patient's heart rate 52, and the order is for digoxin, which, you know, slows the heart rate.
Yeah.
Are they reporting new chest pain? You're collecting all that data vitals, what the client says, the specific order, their history.
But what happens if your data is incomplete? Or, you know, maybe it's conflicting. That initial loop could just stall right there. I imagine that's a huge source of error.
It is a massive source of error. I mean, if you don't notice that the patient's labs show low potassium and a digoxin is ordered.
Yeah.
You've missed a critical cue. If that loop stalls, you have to stop. You have to halt the process and go find more data from the provider, from the chart, from the lab. You just can't move on until that noticing, that assessment phase is solid.
So once you have all the data, we move into the really intensive middle section, interpreting. This is where raw data starts to have meaning.
Interpreting is the heaviest lifting, for sure. It actually spans two stages of the nursing process, analysis and then planning.
And in the cognitive operations, that covers three different steps.
Right. It's analyze QSO, making sense of the low heart rate and the digoxin order. Then it's prioritize hypothesis, deciding the most immediate problem is, say, bradycardia. And finally, generate solutions, which is formulating your intervention, like holding the medication or calling the provider.
So this is where you ask those key questions. Does this drug make sense for this patient right now? Is the dose safe given their kidney function?
Exactly. So in your example, the nurse notices the heart rate of 52. They interpret that the medication could cause harm, so they've generated the solution. I need to hold this dose and call the doctor. Then comes the action.
Which is responding in the Tanner model.
Or implementation in the nursing process. Mm-hmm. Or take actions in the cognitive model. And this is the moment of truth. It's either administering the drug or, like in this case, the decision not to administer and instead communicate your concern.
And then the loop closes with reflecting.
Reflecting. This is evaluation in the nursing process, or evaluate outcomes. And this is absolutely non-negotiable in pharmacology. If you gave a powerful antihypertensive, you have to circle back, go back in 30 minutes, an hour, whatever the peak onset is, and check that blood pressure again.
Or if you gave pain medication, you have to go back and check the pain score.
You have to. This feedback loop tells you if your initial judgment was correct, and it informs everything you do next.
That clinical judgment loop is so vital. And it shows that safe practice doesn't end when the pill is swallowed. It immediately transitions into that other core responsibility, client monitoring.
Exactly. And we can break monitoring down into two big areas. The first one is pretty straightforward, monitoring therapeutic effect.
Is the drug actually working?
That's it. Is it doing what it's supposed to do? If you give a diuretic, is the client's urine output increasing? If you give an antibiotic, is the fever coming down? This is your primary check that the treatment is effective.
Then there's the second area, which is often more acute, more dramatic, monitoring for adverse effects, watching for the bad stuff.
Yes. And you have to be able to distinguish between different types of adverse drug reactions. The most immediate concern is always an allergic reaction. It's an immune-mediated response.
Right, and trying to recall a laundry list of symptoms in a high-stress moment, it's impossible. So let's group them by body system, like in our source material.
Good idea. Let's think systemically. So for the skin, the integumentary system, you're looking for itching, rash, hives, maybe some flushing.
Okay, then the respiratory system. This is where it gets scary.
This is where it gets immediately critical. You're watching for any sign of airway compromise. Rhinitis, nasal congestion, sneezing, wheezing, or just difficulty breathing, dyspnea. Any of those are red flags.
And then there are the systemic effects, the ones that impact consciousness and circulation.
Right. Neurological effects can be anything from confusion or anxiety all the way to loss of consciousness. Circulatory issues, that's usually hypotension, a drop in blood pressure. And critically, watch for localized swelling of the lips and tongue. That's an airway that's closing fast. Or even more general gastrointestinal symptoms like nausea, vomiting, or diarrhea.
And if you see any of that, you stop everything.
You stop everything immediately. The second, less predictable type of reaction is an idiosyncratic drug reaction.
These are much harder to see coming.
Much harder. Unlike an allergic reaction, which is your immune system, an idiosyncratic reaction is, well, it's an abnormal response rooted in the client's own genetics or metabolism. It's usually totally unrelated to the drug's intended purpose.
Like what?
For example, some people might get a severe, unexplained fever when taking a drug that almost never causes a fever in anyone else. Your role in monitoring is to make sure the client gets the benefit of the drug while your vigilance protects them from harm.
So since we know that monitoring is so critical, let's talk about the rigid systems that are built to prevent those adverse effects from happening in the first place. And this brings us to the rights of medication administration.
Yes. The purpose of the rights is singular, but it's profound. To prevent administration errors. For decades, the standard was the five original rights.
Right client, right drug, right dose, right route, and right time.
The non-negotiables. The things you had to check before you pushed a pill or started an IV.
But our sources specifically mention additional rights. So why weren't the original five enough? Why did we have to expand this mantra?
Well, the evolution of the rights really reflects the evolution of how we analyze errors. The original five focused on the physical act of giving the drug. The additional rights came about to cover the gaps in, process, documentation, and communication.
It's a more complex environment now.
It is. So now you have rights like right documentation. Did you chart it correctly to avoid double dosing? Right reason. Are you giving this Tylenol because the patient is in pain or because the order is just confusing? You have right assessment, right response, and right education. These additional rights, they address the complexity and liability of modern healthcare. They're absolutely critical.
It's clear that relying on human memory alone, even with 10 rights to check off, it's inherently flawed, especially in a fast-paced unit, which is why technology has become this ultimate safety net.
This is where systems meet safety, for sure. The first tech layer is the Electronic Medication Administration Record, the EMAR.
The EMAR is the digital backbone. It gets rid of those awful, illegible paper charts, and it standardizes when and how a med was ordered and given. So that reinforces right time and right documentation right there.
But the real star in taking the human factor out of it is Barcode Medication Administration, or BCMA. This is a literal system check right at the bedside.
I love BCMA. It's the perfect example of a system check. It forces you to verify the order and prevents so many potential errors.
It's designed to connect those three essential data points.
Yeah.
The client, which you verify by scanning their wristband, the drug, which you verify by scanning the package, and the order, which you verify against the EMAer. If you try to give a drug the system doesn't recognize for that patient, or if the wristband doesn't match, it just locks you out.
It's a hard stop. It prevents right client and right drug errors.
It does. But, you know, there's a real-world challenge with this technology.
Alert fatigue?
Exactly. As a clinician, how do you handle constant pop-ups, and most of them are irrelevant, without just starting to override the system?
That's a huge problem.
It is. The danger of alert fatigue, just constantly clicking override because 99% of the warnings aren't critical, that's a well-documented source of latent failure. The technology is only as good as the clinician's discipline. Your job as the nurse is to treat every single alert seriously, even the small ones. That's your clinical judgment overriding convenience.
And pushing that safety check even further up the chain before the drug even gets to the floor is computerized provider order entry, or CPOE.
CPOE is a key upstream strategy. It improves safety by standardizing the whole order process. It gets rid of transcription errors from bad handwriting, and crucially, it forces the provider to select from a standardized menu. It can instantly flag basic contraindications or dangerous interactions right at the moment of prescribing.
So it prevents a bad or incomplete order from ever even reaching the nurse.
That's the goal.
So we have the human judgment, the safety rights, the technology. Now let's just quickly touch on the sheer breadth of technical skill that's required. The route of administration determines everything.
Yeah. It absolutely does. The route influences absorption, onset of action, the technique you have to use, sterile versus clean. A nurse has to be proficient in a huge range of methods. Our sources list 12 specific routes, which we can kind of group for clarity.
Right.
You have the enteral routes, oral, sublingual, buccal, rectal, vaginal, nasal. That's where the drug goes into the GI tract or mucosal membrane. Then you have parenteral, the injectables, 40 AM, subcutaneous intradermal. These bypass the GI tract and require sterile technique. And finally, you have topical leather, like inhalation, atelic, ophthalmic, and transdermal.
And that list just drives home how much specialized knowledge you need. I mean, choosing the sublingual route means you need a rapid onset. Choosing a transdermal patch means you want a slow, sustained release. The nurse has to know the implication of that route for every single drug.
Absolutely. And moving from that technical foundation, we get into the daily, messy reality of nursing, managing a dozen tasks and working in a team. A nurse is constantly juggling the medication administration process for a whole group of clients.
And the biggest dangers here are those systemic challenges, right? The constant interruptions on a busy unit, which we know predict errors, and then trying to handle emergencies where your whole schedule just goes out the window.
And that's all compounded by the need to stick to strict medication timing. Certain drugs, insulin, blood pressure meds, timed antibiotics, they have to be given in a very tight window to work properly or prevent harm. This forces you to constantly use frameworks to decide, what do I do first?
Our sources give us two classic frameworks for that. The first is the immediate life-saving one, ABCs.
Airway, breathing, circulation. This is the non-negotiable triage framework. If a client suddenly has shortness of breath, a B problem, nothing else matters. A routine dressing change, a scheduled antibiotic, even charting, it's all secondary. You deal with the most immediate threat to life.
But for the broader, less acute needs, there's the second framework, Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Maslow's is that classic pyramid model. You prioritize from the foundational base and work your way up. So the base is physiological needs, breathing, food, water, pain control.
Then above that is safety needs, fall risks, a secure environment.
Exactly. Then you get to the higher order needs, love, belonging, esteem, and finally self-actualization.
Okay, let's put this into a scenario. You have two clients. Client A is in acute, severe, uncontrolled pain, a 10 out of 10. That's a physiological need. Client B is anxious about their upcoming discharge and hasn't signed their education form yet, an esteem or self-actualization need. Who do you see first?
Client A. No question. Pain is a physiological need that compromises safety and recovery. But let's change the scenario. What if client A has that 10 out of 10 pain, but client C suddenly starts experiencing new rapid onset dyspnea and ABC problem?
The ABCs always win. Even though pain is a high priority physiological need on the Maslow pyramid, an immediate threat to airway, breathing, or circulation trumps everything else.
Exactly. The ABC framework operates within that physiological need category. It demands you pay attention to the most life-threatening elements first. You stabilize the B problem, and then you go manage the pain problem. That's the synthesis that clinical judgment requires every minute of the day.
And moving from your own internal prioritization to the external world, safe practice is just. It's completely dependent on good communication and collaboration, No nurse is an island.
Not at all. And we have to acknowledge the core health team members in every single dose. The provider writes the order, hopefully through CPOE. The pharmacist confirms it, checks for interactions, dispenses the right formulation. The nurse administers and monitors, and sometimes assistive personnel are involved, collecting vitals or IO data that you need for your assessment.
So when an order looks weird or the monitoring shows a bad trend, that's where interprofessional collaboration becomes so important.
Yes. The nurse has to feel empowered to call the provider, to call the pharmacist. Pharmacists, especially, are the experts in kinetics and dynamics. If you're questioning a calculation or a weird interaction, they are your best friend. This collaborative approach leads directly to safer care.
And when communication has to be really structured, especially during a transfer of care, we rely on specific tools. That critical moment is handoff communication.
Handoff needs the discipline of a tool like ASPAR. Using a standard script just prevents vital information from getting lost in the shuffle.
So let's break that down. I is for identify who you are and who the patient is.
S is the situation, why we're talking right now. B is background relevant history, diagnosis, meds. A is your assessment, latest vitals, labs, what you found. R is your recommendation, what do you think needs to happen? And then the final crucial step, R for read back orders to confirm any new instructions.
So a bad handoff is, hey, the patient in room 3 is fine, just needs his BP meds.
Right. A good ISBAR handoff sounds completely different. I'm calling about Mrs. Smith in 302, situation. She had a hypotensive episode at 1400. Background, she's on lisinopril 10 milligram daily. Assessment, her BP is now 102.64, heart rate 98. Recommendation, I held the lisinopril and I suggest you confirm with the provider if this dose should be cut. Please read back the order to hold the drug.
The difference is just night and day. It's clarity versus chaos.
And if ISBAR structures the verbal exchange, then medication reconciliation structures the paperwork, especially during those big transitions.
MedRec. This is arguably the single most effective thing a nurse does to fight against a fragmented healthcare system. You see it constantly in the hospital, on admission, during a transfer, at discharge.
The goals are so important. First, prevent errors from incomplete records. And second, prevent dangerous medication interactions when the drugs a patient takes at home clash with what they're getting in the hospital.
And that list has to be totally comprehensive. It's not just prescriptions. It's all the over-the-counter medications, aspirin, cough syrup, and all the supplements, herbal teas, vitamins, you name it. That stuff is a massive blind spot if you don't ask.
It is. And the process for MedRec is a critical four-step loop. Step one, obtain the list. You have to elect and verify every single medication. You interview the client, their family, maybe call their pharmacy. This is the hardest part, getting an accurate recall.
Step two, validate each medication in the medical record. You're clarifying dosages, making sure everything is correct and up to date.
Step three, compare the current list against the medical record. You are actively hunting for discrepancies. Is there a duplication? Is the home dose different from the hospital dose? You have to find those differences.
And then step four, communicate changes. This closes the loop.
Right. You document and update the final correct list. You educate the client on what they should be taking, especially at discharge. And you commit to reviewing that list regularly. It's not a one and done checkbox.
And all of this has to be applied through the lens of the individual patient. Safe medication administration is so highly individualized, it varies across the entire human lifespan.
It really does. A standard dose for a 40-year-old could be toxic for a toddler, or totally ineffective for a 90-year-old.
So that means there's a constant need for dosage adjustments. And they're not just based on weight and age, but crucially on organ function, especially renal function.
Kidneys and liver. An older adult with decreased kidney function is going to clear a drug much more slowly, so they'll need a reduced dose to prevent toxicity. It also impacts the formulations, you know, crushing pills, or using liquids for kids or people who can't swallow, and the monitoring parameters. A normal heart rate for a baby is very different than for an adult.
Let's really focus in on the population with the highest risk for these complications. Older adults, they are so often dealing with polypharmacy.
Taking multiple medications, often prescribed by different specialists who might not be talking to each other, it's a huge vulnerability. Our sources say that prescriptions result in serious side effects for about 1 in 6 older adults.
1 in 6? That's a staggering number.
It is. This isn't a theoretical problem. It's happening every day. And it costs the system an enormous amount. This is what led to the identification of potentially inappropriate medications, or PIMs.
So these are drugs where the risks, like falls or confusion, just might outweigh the benefits, especially in frail older adults.
Exactly. And the global standard tool we use to identify these PIMS is the Beers List.
The Beers List isn't static, right? It gets updated.
It does. The American Geriatric Society, the AGS, updates it regularly. It gives really clear guidance. For instance, it suggests avoiding certain types of highly sedating benzodiazepines or certain anticholinergic drugs in older adults because they dramatically increase the risk of confusion and falls.
And the financial cost you mentioned really drives this home.
It does. Healthcare costs related to these PIMS are estimated at around $7 billion. So knowing the Beers List allows a nurse to challenge an order with actual evidence. You become that critical checkpoint against dangerous prescribing habits.
And while geriatrics is high risk, we have to acknowledge the specialized needs of pediatrics. Our sources mention the Kids List, which is a similar resource for guiding safe prescribing in children.
And for women who are pregnant or lactating, the Pregnancy and Lactation Labeling Rule was a huge step forward in safety. It replaced that old, vague A, B, C, D, X letter system.
Why was that old system so bad? It just gave a letter, but no real context.
Exactly. It gave you a grade, but zero guidance. The new rule mandates comprehensive, detailed information. It has a risk summary, clinical considerations about how to manage exposure, and the actual data from human or animal studies. It gives clinicians much better evidence to make informed decisions with their patients.
And finally, even if the patient and the dose are right, the drug combination itself might be dangerous. We have to distinguish between medication incompatibility and drug interactions.
Right. Medication incompatibility usually happens externally, like in an IV bag or a syringe. A physical incompatibility might be you see cloudiness or crystals form when you mix two IV drugs. A chemical incompatibility means one drug is breaking down or inactivating the other.
Whereas drug interactions happen inside the body, it's the pharmacological risk where one drug enhances or diminishes the effect of another, like a common antibiotic making an oral contraceptive less effective.
That's a perfect example.
Okay, so this leads us right into the inevitable discussion of errors. How do we define a medication error, an MAE, and what are the consequences?
Well, an MAE is fundamentally a failure to administer a drug correctly. It's a mistake anywhere in that process. The consequences can range from minor discomfort to serious outcomes, which we call adverse drug events or ADEs. The most severe ones are sentinel events.
A sentinel event isn't just an error, it's a catastrophe. Our sources define it as an unexpected occurrence involving death or serious physical or psychological injury.
And when that happens, it triggers an immediate mandatory investigation, a root cause analysis. But, you know, the nurse's role in safety is broader than just reporting full-blown errors. It's about identifying and reporting near misses.
A near miss is when an error could have caused harm, but it was caught just in time.
Exactly. Maybe the BCMA system caught it, or another nurse double-checking. Reporting those near misses is the lifeblood of building a strong culture of client safety.
Let's talk about that culture, because the paradigm shift didn't just happen. It was driven by one single seismic report back in 1999. To err is human, building a safer health system.
That report was monumental. It just shocked the healthcare world. It exposed the staggering number of preventable deaths happening in U.S. hospitals because of errors. Before that report, the focus was often on blame punishing the individual nurse or doctor. This report forced a shift towards systems-based approaches. The question changed from who made the mistake to what in the system allowed the mistake to happen.
And that thinking led to the creation of national safety bodies, like the National Center for Patient Safety, the QSEN Goals for Nursing Education, and the work of the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, AHRQ.
AHRQ developed tools like the Team Step Yes program. It's a set of concrete, structured communication and leadership tools designed to reduce teamwork failures, which are a massive contributor to errors in high-stress environments.
And when we talk about human error within these systems, it's important to classify the types of errors. Not all mistakes are just carelessness.
Right, we can broadly categorize them. The first is a mistake, which is about flawed execution from a knowledge or rule problem. So you have rule-based errors like forgetting to check a patient's ID and knowledge-based errors where the mistake happened because you lacked information, maybe about a rare drug.
And the second type is the skill-based error, which is so relevant to routine nursing tasks.
A skill-based error is when your intention was correct, but your execution was flawed. Our source calls these activity-based errors. They're often slips or lapses during repetitive tasks. Think about a nurse drawing up insulin. They get interrupted for a second, a slip of attention, and they accidentally pull up one millimel too much. The intention was right, the skill failed because of fatigue or distraction.
And we know the common factors that lead to these errors, things like incomplete prescriptions, calculation errors, and just simple administration errors at the bedside.
All of which leads to the Swiss cheese model, which is the visual centerpiece of a root cause analysis.
Such a great metaphor. Explain how it works.
Okay, so imagine you have a stack of Swiss cheese slices. Each slice is a defensive layer in your system organizational policies, say supervision, preconditions, and finally the clinician's own actions.
And the holes in the cheese are the latent failures, the weaknesses.
Exactly. An accident only happens when, just by bad luck, the holes in all of those layers temporarily align. It allows the hazard to pass straight through and reach the client.
So let's apply that to a digoxin error. How would the holes line up?
Well, the first layer, organizational influences, the hole, might be chronic understaffing. The next layer, unsafe supervision, the hole, is no policy for double-checking high-risk meds. Then preconditions, the nurse is fatigued and gets interrupted. And finally, the unsafe act, the nurse miscalculates the dose. When all those holes line up, the error reaches the patient. RCA is about plugging the latent holes in the system, not just blaming the nurse for the final act.
The systems are there to minimize risk, but if an error does happen, the nurse's immediate response is critical. There's a three-step mandatory response.
It's sequential and it's absolute. First, and most important, assess the client. You have to immediately determine their status and if any harm was caused. Second, notify the provider. Immediate communication to get new orders or countermeasures. And third, document the incident factually, according to policy.
And that documentation has to feed back into the safety culture. The biggest barrier to reporting is often just fear.
Precisely. To foster a culture of safety, organizations have to remove those barriers. If nurses are afraid of being punished, they'll hide the near miss, and the organization loses the chance to plug a hole in the Swiss cheese. A just culture focuses on fixing the system first.
All right, now for the section that requires the most precision, medication calculations. We've said that calculation errors are a huge source of MAEs. For nursing students, it's not just a test question, it's a critical safety skill.
It's completely non-negotiable. Calculation errors are avoidable, but only with absolute mastery. That means being fluent in different measurement systems, yeah. Imperial, household, and metric, and being able to do conversions accurately. You also have to be fluent in the 24-hour clock to prevent dosing errors.
And beyond the systems, the single most critical factor is using the correct rounding rules. The precision you need changes based on the form of the medication and the clinical setting.
Let's detail these because they are so fundamental. For capsules, it's simple. Round to the nearest whole number. You can only do whole capsules.
For tablets, it's a little more nuanced.
You generally round to the nearest whole number. But if the tablet is scored, meaning it's designed to be split, you can round to the nearest 0.5 or one decimal place. If your calculation is, say, 0.8 tablets, you round to 1. If it's 0.4, you'd round to 0.5. If the tablet isn't scored and you need to split it, you have to call the pharmacy for a different formulation.
Okay, and precision really goes up for liquid medicines and injections, especially those over 1 mL.
It does. The rounding rule is dictated by your syringe. Generally, for volumes over 1 mL, you round to the nearest tenth, one decimal place. For a very small, critical volume, using a small 1 mL syringe, you might even need to round to the hundredths, two decimal places, if the syringe allows for it. Stacy says you use the smallest, most precise syringe you can for small volumes.
And for IV infusions, there's a big distinction between standard adult care and critical care or PEDS.
A huge one. For standard IV infusions in MLHR for adults, you round to the nearest whole number. The pump is set to 80, not 79.6. But in critical care or for a child, the patient is much more sensitive to fluid and dose changes. So there, you must be more precise. You round to the nearest tenth, one decimal place.
That's a life-saving distinction. And if you're calculating in dropsmen for a gravity drip, you always round to the nearest whole number. You can't give half a drop.
Exactly. Now let's lock this in with the three core calculation methods. We'll use the classic example. Provider orders 500 milligrams of amoxicillin. The pharmacy sends a suspension that's 250 milligrams per 5 mL. The answer we're looking for is 10 milligrams.
All right, let's start with the desired over half formula method.
This is the one most people remember. The formula is simple. Sex X frac desired half times quantity dare. So our desired dose is 500 milligrams. The dose we have is 250 milligrams. And the quantity it comes in is 5 milligrams. You plug it in, sex X is frac 500 millivolare times 5 millivolare.
So 500 divided by 250 is 2. And 2 times 5 milligrau gives us 10 LRL, simple and direct.
Next is the ratio and proportion method. This is the cross-multiplication method. You set up two equal ratios. The formula is frax valve quantity fractazar.
Okay, so setting that up, frac valve 250 mil for frac carbon millera, we cross-multiply, which gives us $250 after 5 times 500.
So 250 escalates with $2,500, divide 2,500 by 250, and X is 10 LRL. Again, it confirms our answer.
And finally, dimensional analysis. This is often preferred for more complex problems because it uses unit cancellation to prevent mistakes.
Right. If your units don't cancel out, you know you set the problem up wrong. The formula is basically setting up a chain of fractions. We want to end up with ML, so we start with that unit in the numerator.
So we set it up as frac for 5 Lenny Millery times fractum favorator.
Perfect. Notice how the mg unit in the denominator of the first fraction cancels out the mg in the numerator of the second. You're left only with ml. The math is frac for theta 5 times $500, which is frac paper fee 5th, equaling 10 ml. Mastering all three lets you check your own work under pressure.
The last more advanced skill we need to cover is the body surface area BSA method. This isn't for everyday drugs.
No. BSA is for very specialized dosing. You see a lot with chemotherapy agents or in pediatric critical care, where a tiny error could be catastrophic. It adjusts the dose based on the client's weight and height, giving a highly personalized dose based on their physical size, measured in square meters.
And there are two formulas, depending on whether you're using metric or imperial. The first uses kilograms and centimeters.
That formula is BSA in kilograms times height in SNPO is $600. So for a client who's 102.5 kilograms and 180 centimeters tall, that calculation gives you $2.26 Miller's $2. You then use that BSA value to calculate the final dose, which might be, say, 50 milligrams per square meter.
And the second formula uses pounds and inches.
That one is BSA, scorpfrac weight in pounds times height in inches 3,131. So for a client who is 132 pounds and 67 inches tall, the calculation gives you $1.68,202. It just underscores the incredibly high stakes of this practice.
We have covered the entire clinical pathway, from the cognitive process of clinical judgment all the way to the intense precision of dosage calculations. This deep dive has really shown that nursing pharmacology is fundamentally about mastering systems.
It is, and the key takeaways have to be solid. Remember the evolution of safety mastering all 10 rites of medication administration, not just the original 5. And use the technology, like BCMA, to back you up. And you have to embrace interprofessional consultation. Talk to the provider, talk to the pharmacist.
And internalize those safety nets. Use medication reconciliation at every single transition of care to fight against fragmented records. And finally, you just have to be fluent in multiple calculation methods to double check your own work, because you, the nurse, are the final critical check in the entire system.
And, you know, we talked about the power of evidence-based practice, EBP. It relies on constantly evolving information primary research like RCTs, secondary research like systematic reviews. The nurse who understands this isn't just following orders. They're thinking critically about the evidence behind the order.
So here's the final provocative thought for you, the learner, to consider. We use the Swiss cheese model to show how latent errors line up to cause an accident. So what happens when an order comes through CPOE? It passes the pharmacist. It aligns with hospital policy. But you, the proactive nurse, you notice a brand new systematic review suggesting a high-risk interaction for this specific patient's profile. How does your mastery of EBP give you the evidence and the authority to ethically question that order?
Acting as that ultimate safety barrier requires staying relentlessly up to date. It gives you the professional standing to pause the entire system, to demand clarification, and to protect your client against a systemic failure. That's the power and the ultimate responsibility of the evidence-based nurse.
We'll see you next time on The Deep Dive.